Hello, and welcome to another SNL Energy podcast. I'm Jennifer Zajac, senior editor here, and with us today is Phil Spector. He's a tax partner with Troutman Sanders New York office, and today we'll be talking about financing for renewable projects. Good morning, Phil.
Good morning. Thank you, Jennifer. I'm pleased to be here.
Representative Earl Blumenauer's House bill proposes changing the federal cash grant program to a tax refund. Phil, what are the advantages and disadvantages to this potential change for renewable projects?
Well, just to give very brief background, we have a form of the tax incentive for solar and for wind, actually, as well, changed in early last year, where the legislation modified the tax credit by requiring the Treasury Department to provide cash grants in lieu of the tax credit. And the grant program has been very successful. The Treasury has awarded about $2.3 billion in cash grants, I think, through the end of 2009. The program itself, though, is scheduled to sunset and to expire, and the industry is looking for an extension of this program. Now, a very simple fix would be to extend the date for the requirement that the commencement of construction begin. Right now, that date is the end of this year, so the industry is looking for an extension of that until the end of 2011 or 2012. The proposal that you mentioned, Representative Blumenauer's bill, would extend the program, but it would convert it into a refundable investment tax credit rather than a Treasury cash grant. And I think the reasons for this are largely administrative. The normal way that you would administer a refundable tax credit, like the earned income credit, which is part of the tax code, is to require applicants to essentially claim the credit on their tax return. And all of the due diligence that would go into determining whether you would be eligible for the credit would be determined by the taxpayer and would be reviewed, if at all, on audit by the Treasury Department. Whereas today, the current grant program requires a one-time application to a kind of standalone bureaucracy that Treasury has had to construct in order to implement the cash grant program. So the proposal would make it a more conventional type of refundable tax credit, and I think viewed as more self-administering, would eliminate the need for the Treasury bureaucracy. The disadvantages to going from a cash grant to a refundable credit largely are timing. And so they would affect the timing which the applicant benefits from the incentive. Under the cash grant program today, the grant may be collected from Treasury within 60 days after the project is completed. If it is converted into a refundable tax credit, then the applicant would have to file a tax return for the taxable year that includes the day on which the project was placed in service and was commercially operable. And then you would only get the money back as a refund after that taxpayer has filed that tax return. So there would be a delay in the amount of time one would have to wait for the payment. That's really the chief disadvantage.
Phil, I would imagine that a lot of industry folks would not be happy about this proposed change. What are you hearing?
It's really not so bad. This is really what the industry asked for originally when this type of incentive was being considered early in 2009. At least proponents of the solar industry preferred this to a cash grant program, probably because they expected that the grant might involve a lot of Treasury administration and bureaucracy. I mean, in retrospect, the grant program has been successful and has worked pretty well on a streamlined basis. But I think an advantage to the refundable tax credit is that all of the information that needs to be collected to make an application for the cash grant, which includes certifications from engineers, might include an accountant certification, all of that would be done by the taxpayer without any initial oversight by the IRS, and instead would be reviewed, if at all, when the taxpayer is audited. He would then have to produce all that documentation, which today has to be produced as a prerequisite to getting the grant.
What is your outlook on the legislation getting passed before the Treasury grant program expires at the end of this year?
Hopefully it will happen before expiration, and exactly how the Blumenauer bill and other bills that are kind of standing alone relating to this issue and just going for an extension, those bills have to get some support, And I think the way they're going to get passed is by having them tacked on to something larger that will gain some momentum in Congress. There was some talk about it being tacked on to a jobs bill that the Senate Finance Committee was considering. There is a kind of tax technical corrections bill floating around, which would make a lot of corrections to the 2009 Recovery Act tax provisions, which this could logically be tacked on to. But I think the more likely situation is that, as traction seems to build as it is currently on climate legislation, now that the health care bill has been completed, these bills for extensions of these incentives are likely to be considered along with those larger energy bills.
Phil, we've been talking about that looming deadline, December 31st, 2010, for project developers to get the projects going in order to qualify for the U.S. Treasury grant program. Phil, from what I'm hearing, project developers are struggling with demonstrating that a project has conducted, quote, physical work of a significant nature, at least before that deadline, in order to qualify. What are project developers going to do to meet that deadline? Is there any action project developers can take if the government says, we've evaluated this and significant work has not been done? And can you just even clarify who determines whether or not it's significant work that has been completed prior to December 31st?
The question of who determines is either it is or it isn't. And the parties, the Treasury Department on the one hand and the developer on the other, can argue about that. And presumably, if they really can't come to an agreement, they can probably not appeal, because I don't think there are any appeals from a Treasury decision to deny a 1603 grant. So I think ultimately the government determines whether significant work has or has not been done. What developers are doing now is there was some lack of clarity in guidance that was issued last year, which has been clarified now by the Treasury Department, in terms of how a developer can demonstrate physical work of a significant nature has begun. One of the ways that they can demonstrate that under the statute is taking advantage of a safe harbor. And under this safe harbor, the developer has to show that at least 5% of the costs of the project have been incurred. And if you can demonstrate that on paper, then you are deemed to have commenced construction. And what was confusing under the earlier guidance was in a case where a developer has contracted with a third party, say, to supply a part for a wind turbine, it wasn't clear whether it would count toward that 5% as the wind turbine was being built for the taxpayer, or whether the taxpayer had to wait until it actually accepted delivery of the part and paid for it until it could count that payment toward the 5%. The clarification came in March, I believe, of this year, where the costs incurred by the party that is supplying that part, even though the part has not yet been delivered and even though the developer has not yet paid for the part, as those costs of constructing that part are incurred by the third party, the developer can take those costs into account in the 5% test. And that's a very important change, because many of these projects involve costs incurred by third-party suppliers of components and parts. So that's a significant development that now allows the developer to take third-party costs, you know, their suppliers' costs into account. What's still kind of not clear is really more of a procedural issue, which is how does the developer go about obtaining that cost data from its third-party suppliers? What will be sufficient to satisfy the safe harbor? Is a letter from the third-party supplier specifying what it has done and what its costs have been, is that sufficient? There might be some sensitivity on the part of the third-party supplier to provide cost data. I mean, they might view that some of that information as confidential. So there is a little bit of question about how exactly a developer goes about getting the information it needs to meet the safe harbor, but the safe harbor is there, and I think developers and Treasury will come to an agreement about that. In terms of the deadline, what I think developers are going to do is they're going to choose those projects which already have a good amount of the preliminary work done, that have a reasonable expectation of commencing construction in 2010, and they are going to look to that 5% safe harbor and gather their costs and anticipate their costs so they can demonstrate that they meet the 5% by December 31st.
Now, another important component when it comes to building a renewable project is securing a power purchase agreement that can make or break a project. Given this push, Phil, for getting renewable projects online sooner than later, are you seeing utilities getting flooded with power purchase agreement proposals?
Well, the way that we've seen the dynamic is most of the utilities that have entered into long-term power purchase agreements for large projects are doing so in response to state laws, so-called renewable portfolio standards, that require those utilities to source a certain amount of their power from renewable sources. And mostly we've seen a lot of action in California on the part of major utilities in California, where at least last year, it was the end of 2008, every other day you'd hear about a giant, this is going to be the largest solar, the utility-scale solar project in the world once it's built. The utilities were under a great deal of pressure to demonstrate to their regulators and to the state that they're satisfying their RPS requirements. So they went out and they issued requests for proposal. So it was the utilities going out and requesting PPAs is what was happening. And for the most part, we saw a lot of PPAs awarded, but not all of them necessarily are going to be built. And utilities, I think, in response to the pressure, satisfy their RPS and to achieve what they felt would be the lowest costs, awarded PPA contracts to parties that were essentially the lowest bidders. And I think a lot of those contracts are now being vetted, and I think there was a lot of underestimation of what the cost to build these facilities would be. And a lot of the PPA rates in those PPAs are simply not realistic. And what's going to happen is a lot of those PPAs are going to be either terminated or renegotiated. And I think a question that the utilities have to grapple with is if you renegotiate a PPA, bringing the rate at which the utility has to buy power up, why shouldn't the utility have to issue that RFP again and allow the other bidders to rebid? That's an issue some of the utilities are struggling with. I think the next development in this area as it relates to utilities is going to be more utility interest in actually owning and operating large-scale renewable projects rather than just sourcing power from them, taking ownership interest in them. That requires them to understand the technology. It requires them to take a little more risk. But it also puts their money and their equity into the project and is favorable development for utilities and for other investors that see utilities putting some skin in the game in terms of ownership of these projects.
And Phil, can you elaborate a little bit more on why you think we're finally going to see utilities get in that game?
Well, the driver is again going to be the state RPS and any federal RES, comparable renewable energy standard that's enacted at the federal level. That's going to be the primary push. However, I think you do see utilities that are not under particular pressure at the moment becoming more interested in owning these projects. For example, you have the case of Southern Company, which entered into a joint venture with Turner and purchased a large utility-scale solar project in progress in development by First Wind. And there's a case where I think the utility realizes that it wants to and needs to mix renewable energy into its portfolio and was able to analyze a project and make a determination that this is something that we can and we want to own. Many of the utilities have tax capacity to provide equity and to take advantage of the tax incentives without the need for third-party tax equity dollars from banks or financial institutions. So many utilities can largely finance these projects on balance sheet, just with their own financial wherewithal, making it a much less complicated transaction and just making it a less complicated transaction.
Right. We've been talking with Phil Spector. He's a tax partner with Troutman Sanders in the New York office. Phil, thanks so much for speaking with us today.
Okay, you're welcome.
All right, and that's another SNL Energy podcast. Thanks for listening.